to your own health and fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman. With Jeff Fawcett, PhD, we come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. Human beings have highly developed pleasure centers. It's what compels us to eat, sleep, and have sex. Our brain rewards us with a waterfall of happy chemicals. It's not at all surprising that as we move away from our place in nature to a modern manufactured world, forces manipulate our pleasure centers to enhance their own pleasure centers. Now we have stuff and stuff and stuff and stuff, but who decides what will be made and sold, and whose responsibility is it when this stuff makes us sick? Gosh, it was easier when the stuff was made down the street by someone you knew and you could talk to. But now we can all talk to each other, whether we know each other or not, and we can buy more stuff. And we can do it all anonymously, or so we think. Do we have more control or less? Are we connected or disconnected? And hey, whose responsibility is it when we get sick? Stay tuned this hour as we explore how the digital revolution is changing our world and our responsibility. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Jeffrey Fawcett.
Thank you, Lena. Calories in equal calories burned plus calories stored. That's the simple formula that alleges to summarize why Americans are fat and growing fatter. It's the energy balance equation. It dominates how scientists as well as the general public thinks about the relationship between food and body fat. It is deeply flawed. How could this be? It's hard to see what could possibly be wrong with it. Yet the way in which the equation is flawed reveals why the so-called obesity epidemic is a symptom of deeper biological disruptions. The obvious disruptions are to energy metabolism with its direct connection to body weight, blood sugar, and fat cells. Somewhat less obviously are disruptions to the cardiovascular, respiratory, and digestive systems that support energy metabolism, and still less obviously are the disruptions to the body's nervous, immune, and hormone systems to which energy metabolism is deeply connected. I'm not going to spend much time on the calories inside of the equation. I just want to point out three things. First, the calculated caloric content of food is not the same as its actual energy contribution when the carbohydrates, fats, and proteins are converted into fuel and circulating in the bloodstream. Second, food has to be digested. If someone's digestion isn't working properly, the potential calories won't actually make it into the circulation as fuel. And third, eating is a dynamic process that sends signals to the body, which in turn signals us to stop eating, or eat more now, or eat more later. This is the part of the equation that gets flogged vigorously in discussions, for example, of how foods are designed to be addictive. What has caught my attention on the other side of the equation is the concept of an obesogen. An obesogen is an exposure that impairs the body's capacity to use fuel effectively. One result is that the body makes the mistake of creating body fat from fuel instead of burning it or getting rid of it as waste. The exposure can be internal or external. It can be in the food or on the food. It can be biochemical or psychosocial. To my mind, the two most powerful obesogens are endocrine disruptors and stress. But let's talk about the energy equation and what its flaws reveal. Calories burned consists of two basic parts. One is energy used to maintain body heat and perform other basic energy functions, such as digesting food. The other is energy used to do work such as walking and pumping blood. Hormones affect both. Thyroid hormones regulate basic metabolism. Stress hormones affect the work of our muscles, including our heart. Both of these hormone systems, plus the sex hormones, affect what the body does with the fuel circulating around the body. In other words, they affect how and where fuel is burned, stored as blood sugar, or as fatty acids and fat cells, and finally excreted as waste. Endocrine disruptors, such as persistent organic pollutants, these include pesticides and herbicides, and chemicals used, for example, in consumer products such as bisphenol A, cause these hormone systems to stop working properly. Basic metabolism, response to stressors, and storage and excretion of fuel are all thrown out of balance. When these are out of balance, circulation, respiration, and digestion are all affected. These disruptions, in their turn, disrupt the immune, digestive, and nervous systems. This happens because all of them are systems of communication that talk to each other. Disruption means the breakdown of the body's communication, and with it, the body's self-regulation. A recent book on the topic of obesogen was turned into a pedestrian weight loss plan. The unfortunate subtitle is, quote, "How Secret Obesogens Are Making Us Fat and the 6-Week Plan That Will Flatten Your Belly for Good." Yes, there is a perky exclamation mark at the end of that sentence. The subtitle is false. There are two reasons I say that. First, this is a perfect example of an inverted quarantine, a phrase coined by sociologist Andrew Sass. Our health is damaged by an environmental assault. But instead of alleviating the source of the assault, we're told to go shopping, but only for the right stuff. Second, and more profoundly, endocrine disruptors and stress don't just cause miscommunication in the tissues of the adult body. In fetuses and children, endocrine disruptors and stress change how their tissues grow. In other words, their organs develop in a way that is dysfunctional to begin with. So even should obesogens be eliminated by some miracle right now, those children's organ systems won't work right. This is a curse that will not be lifted by a 6-week plan that flattens your belly for good. And unfortunately, there's really no magic that will. But lifting the inverted quarantine is a start. A transcript of this editorial is available on the blog at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett's an environmental economist or political economist. He's a writer and health educator who produces this show with me and is primary author of our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health. Now to our show, which is Digital Passivity, and our guest, who we're very happy to have, Douglas Rushkoff, winner of the first Neil Postman Award for Career Achievement in Public Intellectual Activity. Douglas Rushkoff, spelled R-U-S-H-K-O-F-F, Rushkoff, has written a dozen best-selling books on media and society, including Siberia, spelled C-Y-B-E-R-I-A, Media Virus, Coercion, which was winner of the Martian McLuhan Award, Get Back in the Box, and Life, Inc., and we're going to be talking today about Program or Be Programmed. He has made the PBS Frontline documentaries Digital Nation, The Persuaders, and Merchants of Cool. A columnist for The Daily Beast and Arthur Magazine, his articles have been regularly published in The New York Times and Discover, among other publications. His radio commentaries on air on NPR and WPMU. His op-eds appear in The New York Times, and he's a familiar face on television from ABC News to The Colbert Report. Rushkoff has taught at the New York University and the New School, played keyboards for the industrial band Psychic TV, directed for theater and film, and worked as a stage fight choreographer. Always useful. He lives in New York State with his wife, Barbara, and daughter, Mamie. So thank you for joining us.
All right. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So we send out a weekly email to our listeners to tell them what's going to be on the show. And we got an email back from a listener who quoted Roland Barthes, a French literary theorist and philosopher and critic of the 20th century, who he quoted as saying, "Write or be written upon,"
mm-hmm.
before your book came out. So you reach all the way back into human history to the Enlightenment, and you compare the digital revolution in some ways to the Enlightenment. So have we been here before?
Yeah, if anything, you know, I would compare it even more directly to the invention of text in the Axial Age, you know, when people went from being kind of passive receivers of the randomness of nature and the law of the pharaoh, which could, you know, change on a moment's notice, to a covenant, to a Torah, a contract with their deity. You know, that was the main achievement of, you know, the text, the new text civilization, was to put it in writing. You know, what do we have to do and what do we get back? What are our laws? How are we going to live together? And I feel like on a certain level, we seized that opportunity as a civilization, and on another, we didn't seize it at all. You know, people didn't really, they didn't learn to read and write. They learned even 1,000 years later, they were still just gathering in the town square and having the holy books read to them by a rabbi or a minister. You know, it wasn't really, you know, until much later, really, the printing press that people finally learned to read. But the ability on offer with the printing press was to write, you know, was to distribute. And that, again, was reserved by a few elites who had access to the printing presses. If you printed without permission of the court, you were killed, usually. You know, and now we get computers, which I think are, you know, the biggest thing since text. And rather than seizing the capability of this era, which is really programming or understanding programming, building these environments, we've gained the capability of the last one. We can now write in the little blog window on the screen without really knowing anything about the context in which this activity is happening.
Well, that sounds kind of like getting a free ride. That doesn't sound terrible. Why should we be alarmed by this? I mean, I guess the real question is who's pulling the strings in the background?
Right. I mean, if you believe, and many people, you know, do, and kind of along with guys like Walter Lippmann of the early 1900s, that, you know, that there's basically a benevolent elite who can be entrusted with our future, then that's really okay. And I understand why people go there. You know, it's hard to understand what's going on. It's hard to figure out, you know, governance. It's hard to figure out your health. You know, and if, you know, if the doctor and the AMA and the pharmaceutical industry and all these folks and institutions really do have our best interests at heart, then why not just do as they say and go with the program? You know, my problem is that historically these groups they can't be trusted. You know, that they don't act according to our best interests. And in my personal experience, I found, and I don't think I'm that rare in this regard, I found it's actually more fun to have a hand in my own fate. Mm-hmm. That agency, autonomy, cognition, free will, active choice, that all of these are fun ways of going through the world rather than in a kind of a dead passivity. You know, I would rather be a driver or a co-pilot even than just a passenger in the back of the bus.
Yeah, there's a real herd mentality. Human beings really are remarkably like herbivores in that way. And don't think of themselves that way. We think of ourselves as being very powerful and, you know, we can do all sorts of things. And now we feel there's this sense with the digital stuff and the computers that we can do all sorts of things. We have all sorts of choices. We have all these choices and we can fill things in. We can blah, 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 blah. So the part of this that makes me the most uneasy is how successful this marketing campaign has been at, in less than 10 years, making people, as you point out, walk around in a state of constantly being in touch and constantly responding to these messages and possibility of messages. It's like our pleasure centers are being stimulated all the time. There's been studies that have shown that the dopamine receptors in our brains are being tickled and we're having all these gushes of pleasure and we're just totally I shouldn't say we because I don't feel quite this way, but people tend to be very addicted to their cell phone and their little computer cell phone and all of that. And we're not even talking about I won't harp on what the radiation is doing. Well, no, I will harp on what the radiation is doing to our neurons in our brain, which is destroying them. Studies do show this. So there's an illusion that we are very powerful and have choice.
All right. It's the same illusion that you get, you know, walking through the supermarket when you see that aisle filled with, you know, plastic bottles of laundry detergent. You know, you've got maybe 300 or 400 different, you know, laundry detergents that you could choose from, and each one using phosphates to you know, and detergent to clean laundry. You know, you actually don't have a choice of how you will do your laundry, whether you're going to use those little nuts that come from India or soap or anything else. You have a choice of which one of these, you know, Procter & Gamble or Unilever products you're going to use as your washing solution. So it's very easy to be kind of fooled by a wide array of one choice, masquerading as many. And it'll certainly keep you busy. You know, if you just answer everything coming through on your BlackBerry or your email inbox, you can have the experience of having accomplished something over the course of a day, even though you can't quite put your finger on what you've actually gotten done.
You know, the other thing is that in terms of historical perspective of hominids, of human beings, this is a blink of an eye. And for most of our human history, the hunter-gatherer cultures were so acutely in tune with their environment and their bodies and what was going on that they could, Jeffrey did an editorial where he talked about how the people from these cultures could recognize somebody by their footprints in the ground. So there's this incredible sensitivity to the environment, to your body, to your senses. And now, in a blink of an eye, that's being erased because,
well,
yeah.
That's always been the kind of the trade-off with technology. You know, the wonderful thing about technology is, for the most part, it gives us more choice. You know, once you have electric lights, it means you can stay up at night and defeat the natural circadian rhythm of your body. When you've got fire, you can move from the tropics to the cold regions and get away from those big gorillas who don't know how to make fire and can't attack you anymore. You create more and more choices, but you also tend to, you know, disconnect from kind of rhythms and ways your body has evolved of recognizing different situations over time. So it's a trade-off. You know, we're glad for technology. We're glad to have increased the ways in which the environments and ways in which people can live, but the impact on the way our bodies function is rather extreme, and it can take much, much longer for us to adapt to that than it takes us to actually make the new technology.
Yeah, the concern I have is that the sense of choice that we have is a false sense of choice, and that the sense of choice is hypnotizing us into ignoring our actual physical existence in any given moment, which is essentially what we have. I mean, you described this young woman that you followed in New York from club to club with her phone and camera and email and...
Right. She's basically, you know, SMSing, messaging all her friends to find out which party she should be at. Then when she finally gets to that party, she simply turns the phone around and starts taking pictures of that party, uploading it to her Facebook. So she's never actually where she is. She's
either and then she's off.
Place to be, yeah. Or broadcasting where she is to somewhere else. And it's very easy to get in that, you know. I mean, I understand why people want to put the iPods or whatever in their ears while they walk down the street or be in a phone call, because you're like using this time, you're utilizing the time to talk to all these people. But what you've done is you've turned what had been a public space into a bunch of little private spaces, and you've ended up denying yourself something, you know, the walk itself and that experience of seeing other faces and smiling and not that social experience on which you hadn't been able to place a value. You know, there was no metric to measure the value of that time, so you just let it go. Plus, it's not stimulating you in the same way that, you know, the one good message out of the 50, you know, boring ones on your BlackBerry. It doesn't stimulate you in that way, in that same way, almost the exact same ratio as a good one-armed bandit slot machine, you know, doles out a few quarters for every 100 that you put in. That's what creates obsessive-compulsive loops. Mm-hmm. That's what creates compulsions. It's not always getting something good. It's getting something good every once in a while in a sort of randomly dispersed way that you can't predict.
Yeah, you're walking around with your tongue out going, gotta get it, gotta get it, gotta get it, you know?
Right, and the thing is, you get the dopamine hit, but you don't get... I mean, the reason we used to get dopamine hits when we connected to other people, when our mirror neurons in our brains, you know, fire and we go, oh, recognition, oh... Mm. We get that initial thing, but what happens in the real world when after that first hit is then you get a release of oxytocin, which is bonding, you know, which actually bonds you to other people in your tribe or in the world or the mother and the child. You know, you don't get that with these technologies. You get the dopamine hit, but you don't get the follow-up. So then you just look for more and more dopamine. But mm-hmm. it ends up feeling empty, and you end up feeling, you know, usually more disconnected than connected at the end of a series of these encounters.
You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm on the phone with Douglas Rushkoff. Again, it's Rushkoff, and his latest book in a string of other really intelligent and fun reads is this book, Program or Be Programmed, 10 Commandments for a Digital Age. I love this book. Jeffrey's raising his finger.
So you just made the same mistake that Laura Flanders made.
What?
In saying that the subtitle is 10 Commandments. The subtitle
oh,
ten, is
10 commands.
Commands
for a digital age, which is funnier.
Well, and it's also it's more appropriate, you know, in the Torah age, that's all people really needed at that point were commandments, you know, from God in order to have a sort of ethical behavior. And anybody who actually reads Torah finds out, oh, God didn't write these. These are written by, you know, Moses and his brother-in-law figured out the legal system and the rabbis. You know, it was the laws were written by people. But there's still commandments. Now, the idea is that now you have commands, which are not things that you follow, but commands that you make.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a way to have command over this medium rather than just following the commandments that would have mm-hmm. dominion over you.
And I think it was Mel Brooks who did this great skit where he comes out, you know, with the stone tablets, and he comes out and he says, "I'm here with the 11," and then he drops one, and he goes, "The 10, come in."
Yeah, right.
So part of what we're saying, I want to go back to the commands that you go over because I think they're very important. One of the issues here is the old, you know, the old expression, is it real or is it Memorex? And it becomes even more important because we're moving further and further from our natural origins, as we're talking about. And a digital copy, it turns out, from studies, doesn't compel us the same way as the original experience does. It doesn't copy an experience. It does something different. So talk about what it is about the nature of digital media that is disruptive in a certain way.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of things. Digital media is not... it's not an artifact of an event that has happened in real life. In other words, a real painting is something that it's an artifact of the physical world, of an event that happened. A bunch of pigment was thrown onto a thing, and a digital representation is ultimately a number. You know, it's a set of symbols that are used to then recreate something in a machine. So, you know, if you make an analog recording, you know, you play a bunch of instruments. I'm short-circuiting the process a bit, but basically you play a bunch of instruments at a needle that's moving through wax, and because that needle has been vibrated by the sound, it cuts an impression in there, and then you use the wax to make a mold, and you take a bunch of vinyl, and then you make these physical objects that then, when another needle goes in there, it vibrates in that way and recreates the sound. So you have an impression, a physical impression from the real world of something that happened. When you make a digital recording, what you're doing is basically assigning numbers to various parameters of the sound. And it's not that those numbers are bad or that digital recording was an evil, wrong thing. It's that it's not of our universe. It's not of, it's not a physical artifact. It's a digital numeric representation. So when you play it back, when you get, when you use that number to recreate the sound through a computer, which is basically what a CD player is, through a circuit, what you're doing is recreating everything we know about that sound. We're recreating it to the, in some sense, greater fidelity, but it's very rapidly sampled moments that are sort of strung together to create the illusion of recorded sound. So you have sound, you have recorded sound, and now you have the representation of recorded sound, a symbol of recorded sound. And when it doesn't have the same impact on the body, it's a different it's a different thing. I mean, even think about it's not just the fidelity. When you're having a cell phone conversation with somebody, you don't have that same intimacy that you did back in the days of twisted pair analog telephone when you sat up all night talking to your boyfriend or girlfriend on the phone. There was an analog intimacy to that there isn't to these recreations of voice, and you can't respond to it in the same way, and I understand that on paper it looks just as good, Sudafed on paper looks just as good as ephedra, but or Marinol looks as good as cannabis, but it's not, it's playing a certain note, the note that we've identified, but it's not of nature, it's not of this world, and anything that we didn't think to record in that sound is no longer there.
Well, in fact, when they played music, digital music, to depressed patients versus playing, a record, they didn't respond to the digital, and they were soothed by the music on the record.
Right.
I remember this. I recall that I used to listen to music all the time when I had records, and I still do. I'm going to set this back up based on what I read in your book. I just used to get into this reverie, and now I realize that I don't listen to it as much because it just doesn't, I don't like the sound of it as much. It just doesn't seem to hit those chords the way.
Right. And we're of the generation that experienced that other thing.
Yeah.
So we kind of know what it is. They're finding now that kids who are raised on digital music really can no longer hear the difference. And it's not just that the recording technology has gotten better, which it has. It's that they're actually losing certain sounds. There's things that they can't hear. It's just like, if you don't hear, the sounds of certain languages by a certain age, you kind of will never be able to distinguish them. They're finding that kids now, when they're testing them on what aspects of classical music can they hear, they can't hear the subtle differences in playing that are considered part of the vocabulary of classical music.
That's very sad.
Well, it can be said it's
I know
different.
It's things.
I'm trying to not be judgmental about it. When the fish, sheds its scales and gets its legs and walks on land, all the fish who are in the water are like, Joe, you can't breathe anymore. And Joe is like, well, it's okay, I got legs and I'm doing this other thing. And I'm trying to be okay with that other thing as long as they do that other thing.
Well, and also, but as long as they're actually engaged,
right,
rather than just being led around by a ring in their nose.
Right. So if we moved from the industrial age consumer reality into a genuine digital age creative reality, one where people, instead of consuming, they actually actively created and understood their part in the creation of the world that they're inhabiting, I'll take the bad with the good, and I'll say, okay, I get it. There's trade-offs as we move into these new realms. But when I see a kid using Facebook today, I'm not seeing a kid understanding what the game is here. You talk to a kid and ask him what's Facebook for, they'll say, oh, Facebook is here to help me make friends. And that's not what Facebook is here for. Facebook is here to help a company monetize that kid's social relationships, or to help companies figure out new ways of branding through, peer-to-peer digital media. And if they don't recognize that, I don't see how they can be the sort of human beings of a digital age. They end up being more the machines in a digital age.
Right. Right. It's like we have these very intelligent machines that are actually spending more time thinking than we are.
Right. I mean, every interaction you have with one of these websites or social networks, the technology is learning more about us.
Mm-hmm.
Right. How many times are we learning more about the technology by doing it? We're not. And while I am an equal opportunity evolutionary theorist, and it's possible that technology will be the way that matter evolves into greater complexity in the face of entropy, in this great, story of the universe, I would like at least for human beings and biology to come along for the ride.
Wouldn't that be nice? Yeah, I like that idea. I have to take a brief musical break. You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness, Lena Berman here with Jeff Fawcett, and we're on the phone with Douglas Rush Koff, R-U-S-H-K-O-F-F, the book again, Program or Be Programmed, 10 Commands for a Digital Age. We're going to take a brief musical break, if you would stay with us, please. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett. We are on the phone today with Douglas Rushkoff, R-U-S-H-K-O-F-F, his book, Program or Be Programmed. There's information about Your Own Health and Fitness, our guests, our practice, a free stream of this week's show, our archive, CD copies, our book, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out. You can email us at admin, A-D-M-I-N, at yourownhealthandfitness.org, again, all spelled out. Douglas, do you want to send people to a website?
If they want to buy this book, they could go to orbooks.com. We're kind of avoiding Amazon and all these online retailers who basically have really no real function in terms of the internet. You know, it's interesting that we have the means to do peer-to-peer sales and transactions online now, and what happened is we basically have giant department stores move in and treat it as if it's the same old world, you know, and take 50% of everything that we would normally give to each other. So the book's available for about half of what it would be in a retail environment through orbooks.com, or you can get there by going to rushkoff.com and read a bunch of other stuff I've been doing. It's most of my stuff ends up free on my website anyway, so you can always go there.
Mm-hmm. Well, since you've gone there, I was going to go in a different direction, but let's go there. Let's talk about the illusion. I mean, there's this thing happening where all content is suddenly free, and artists and writers and everybody else no longer has control over their content because it's all free. So one of your commands is not to steal.
Yeah.
Share,
don't steal.
Yeah. I mean, the first command deals with our nervous system, which is to unplug yourself and to recognize the fact that we have these tools so that we actually had more control over our time, and now suddenly it's creating a situation where people have no control over their time, and you're saying take the control back. You don't have to read your email right away. It isn't a phone call.
Right. You don't have to be always on.
Right. So the other problem, which we've run into as well, which is that nothing that you create, if it shows up in any form or any way on the web, it suddenly is free, and people expect free, and people suddenly have no sense of what it takes for people to do work. I mean, it's like you belong, it's being a radio show host, people think you belong to them, sort of. And if you say that you're doing it for free and you'd like them to do something else, they get angry. It's because everything's free. So why don't you talk about this? Because you're also having your own issues with this.
Well, the interesting thing is, I mean, people think that it's free, but it's not. You know, it's free for the consumer, but there's someone on the other side of the screen who's created value, right? That's sort of an old Marxist idea that when someone does something or works, that they're actually creating value with their work. And it's not just that now I've created it and it's being given away. It's that I've created value and the same corporations or similar ones are still extracting value from the work I've done. They're just not passing it on to me. So when I write something and everybody wants it for free and they're all using Google to find it, Google is still making money off my writing. You know, Google is still selling the ad space off every search for everything that they're looking to find on me. And people are getting my stuff for free and they're supposed to be able to cut it up and do what they want. Or they could go buy more computers and software and Final Cut and video cameras and make their mashups of it and then upload it to YouTube. And then they've created value and they're giving it away on YouTube, which is making a ton of money for Google as well. So there's this illusion and this kind of false ethos of, oh, now we're in this other age and everything should be free for everybody. That's really just a way. It's like the myth of open markets. It's a way for the one corporation still standing to make money off all of us and all of our activity.
So the digital age still has a central control, is what you're saying.
It does. And the answer that I'll usually get from not the genuine libertarian side, but the pro-business side of this equation is, well, you could just put Google ads on your website and make the money too. And it's like, yeah, but I believe that once you're putting ads up on your website, then you start writing for the hits. You start writing for the ads. So now I want to write stuff that's going to – I mean, my living's depending on it. I need to write stuff that gets – people to come see it no matter what, and then ideally is a good bed for these advertisers. So how do I create articles that promote click-through to the ad so that I get paid for it? That's a very different model than, you know, bless his heart, I know we got problems with him, but it's a different model than Rupert Murdoch paying me $50,000 or something to write a book that then he sells through his stores and distribution networks. At least he's cutting me in on – he's paying me for my work. He's not paying me for my work to be an advertising bed for something else.
Yeah, you just described the difference between NPR and Pacifica.
I heard you.
But it's still going on. It just goes on and on and on. And you just hold your breath and you wonder if, you know, is this my last day on radio? Is my calling a wrong number? Is it what's going to happen? So while I keep doing my free content,
exactly, it's like fighting. You're fighting. That's the amazing thing.
Well, to have a voice. It's to have a voice. I mean,
right.
It's that's an honor. I never deny. I mean, to me, being able to have a voice and being heard is an honor, and I take it as such. And I don't.
No, that's the object of the game, and then
right.
You just want to stay alive.
Right.
Do it.
So going, let's back down, let's sort of back through the tunnel a little bit, because you mentioned Marx. So if we go back to the idea of, you know, the collapse of capitalism happens, and suddenly everything's a commodity. And the net was originally designed as this sort of free bazaar, and you compare it, as Jeffrey has compared our situation in the economy, often to going back to the Dark Ages, the feudal ages, where the feudal age didn't stop because of a bloody revolution. It was because people set up commerce of their own, and pretty soon the castle came to them. So for a little while there was an underground economy that worked. And so in a way, the net originally was meant to be that. For it was shareware, and it was all this free stuff, and people could share ideas and connect. And now it's become commoditized. And once again, we lose sight of this thing, everyone to their – what is it, Jeffrey? Say it correctly, the Marxist thing about everyone to their ability.
From each according to their ability to each according to their need.
And please don't sing the national right now. So you know, the idea is that, you know, there's a possibility here that we could, if we do this right, turn this back into a place where people can – share and have. You were even talking about the fact that there's local money is starting to work a little bit on the net.
Right.
So talk about that positive spin here.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, you correctly identify the end of feudalism. It's what I wrote about in my book before this. It's called Life, Inc., where
right.
I really look at did corporations and central currency and all the – where did this come from and why are we so stuck with it? And I found out that they're not what we think they are, that what was happening, feudalism was breaking down. All the peasants, instead of just working for lords, realized, oh, wait a minute, I can make stuff and trade stuff, and we can do things. There were merchants going around finding things in different places and trading, and there was, you know, what we'd call a peer-to-peer economy developed, a real economy. So there were all different local currencies that were grain-based. People were trading with one another, and they had money to do that with. They had small shops and workshops, and the economy started to grow. That's how we got what they called the bourgeois, the middle class. You know, and this was one of the most prosperous couple of centuries in human history. People got healthy. Women were taller than they were, you know, really at any time until the 80s. It was amazing what was going on. But the problem, of course, was that the aristocracy was dying. You know, the aristocracy was losing their ability to exploit labor. The lords didn't have peasants to work for them. So they had to stop this. And what they did was they hired, you know, financiers from really Florence and Egypt to come in and help them develop mechanisms to stop all this. And those were the chartered monopoly or the corporation, which made it illegal for anyone to work in an industry except the king's chartered friend, and centralized currency. They made it illegal to use any currency except coin of the realm. And wars were fought over these innovations. These were not taken lightly. People understood what was happening. They weren't going to be allowed to work anymore. They could work, but they'd have to have jobs instead of companies, instead of businesses. And that's what's been going on the last 500 or 600 years. That's why, you know, Walmart can come in and put all the local merchants out of business. It's because they get their money cheaper. They have better laws for a Walmart than for Joe the druggist. So now we get the net, which really does enable, I can't say it's made for it, but it enables peer-to-peer transaction, peer-to-peer business again. We can start engaging directly with one another again. And that does require us understanding what the tools are and how they work. So instead of having a genuine social networks of peer-to-peer, you know, client-driven or software-driven networks, we use a giant centralized Facebook, you know, one big corporate-owned set of servers to interact with each other on a peer-to-peer medium. We use Amazon.com to trade, you know, rather than, you know, people being able to Amazon isn't so bad because in many cases they only take 10 or 15% of what you're doing. But it's not a use of the medium that's really consonant with how the medium could work. And certainly the ability now to use things other than, you know, Chase and Citibank and Visa and American Express to transact with one another, that's at our fingertips. That's there. It's really just getting over the psychological barriers to exchanging value in ways that doesn't just promote the interest-based or debt-based capitalist system that we've been using.
Yeah, though the pitfall here, I mean, on the one hand, there's the potential for people to begin to set up, as they did during feudal times, their own underground economy and even have it maybe function on the web, to make it into a bazaar again. So that's the benefit of the net, not to be suckered into the big guys and set up the small guys. And look, and I actually wouldn't even know where to look for the small guys at this point. Do you know where to look for the small guys? Are the resources in the back of your book useful for that?
The small, I mean, the other kinds of currency?
Yeah, if you want to, like, indulge in that. I mean, there's Etsy, which is people making their own stuff and selling it.
Etsy,
but
yeah. I mean, there's some guys, I'm just actually going to join up with them. They started something called Superfluid, which is it's basically a collaborative currency. It's a currency that promotes collaboration rather than hoarding. So the idea is instead of trying to get a lot of money, what you try to do is collaborate on lots of different kinds of projects and get stuff and services from people.
So is it you literally just go to Superfluid?
Yeah, Superfluid, or thesuperfluid.com, I think is what it is.
Okay.
I mean, so there's lots, and I'm actually coming out with a paperback of the Life Inc. book that has a big resource guide in the back
That's
of it.
That's
that
has, great.
You know, 30 or 40 examples of different things with local currencies and babysitting clubs and all sorts of, you know, what you're calling underground economy. But I think the banking economy is the underground one. That's the one that's opaque. That's the one that people don't understand is rigged. You know, this money is much too expensive for what it's worth. You know, and it's because of the overhead. You've got to keep so many bankers and investors and derivatives markets alive with every one of our real world transactions. It's just that's why we're all struggling so much. That's why, you know, we have all these technologies, but we're all working more than we ever did before.
And
it's because we've got to fund all these people who don't work. Mm-hmm. We're funding all these people who simply they work. Their work is to extract value from what we do rather than to create value themselves.
Mm-hmm. My fist is in the air. just to let you know.
Yeah, not to get commie on.
No, get commie, get commie. This is KPFA, honey. Get commie.
It's not communist. I'm. If anything, I'm an Adam Smith capitalist. You know, Adam Smith, the hero of supposedly the hero of business community, basically understood that business has to be scaled to local communities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that it's not. He hated corporations as much as he hated government. You know, because he wanted there to be a free economy. And I'm like, if we want to have a free economy, then we should be allowed to have currencies that compete with these private central bank issued currencies. And that's not hard, especially now that we've got the power of the microchip. But that requires a programmer's mindset, which is why I say programmer be programmed.
Yes.
It doesn't just mean learning C and COBOL. It means understanding that the world we live in is programmed, that we are running programs, whether it's democracy or capitalism or bank currency or Christianity. These are programs, and they are all written by people and can be adapted to whatever needs we have now. You know, these are not sacred. They're not set in stone. All you have to do is learn the code, and you can recreate them in any way you want.
If you like what you're hearing, you're listening to Douglas Rushkoff, Rushkoff. This book is Program or Be Programmed. I like this book. I was up late reading it, even though it's not a huge book. I wanted to read every word. Well, part of there are hurdles in the way here a little. And one of them, just to go backwards a little bit, is that there's this shortcoming of people thinking that they can have web stores and how much better this is going to be. You know, the example of the guy who has the record store, the local record store. And so he starts to, you know, and think, oh, I don't have to pay for the brick and mortar, and I don't have to do this and that. And I can have a web store. And he basically went out of business, because as soon as you go up on the web and you start selling stuff, you're competing with Amazon and all the rest of them. So that didn't work out well. Meanwhile, he lost his thing of people being able to stroll into the store and have this personal contact with a human being, with the pheromones and the vibes and all the stuff that happens that we miss. The other thing is that the digital age is very sort of black and white, and it's this decision or that decision, it's numbers, and things are very complex. People, you know, one of the biggest problems I have in my work as a health educator with individuals is getting them to think critically. We've seem to be losing the ability to make critical decisions or to think through things. We tend to jump into, you know, it's either this or that, very fast. People, you don't know how to use the information that's on the web, and they're losing that capacity, as far as I can say, to really think. It's like, you know, you talk about abstraction as opposed to the experience of the real thing. You know, there's this shift that's making things difficult for people to shift into a kind of engaged state.
Right. Well, there's a lot of compulsions that seem to come up when we're online. You know, you want to learn everything about everything, or you move to different links, or I mean, the other thing that happens to me is I start on a task, and for some reason, whatever comes up on the computer, it seems more important at that moment than whatever it is I'm really doing.
It's kind of like the sock drawer when you're trying to write something.
Yeah, kind of.
The sock drawer needs
cleaning. Something, and an email will come in, and I think, oh, I've got to answer that person's. That this, rather than do the thing I was doing, which is also kind of strange.
Mm.
I mean, there's this sense of there is a sense of information overload, which can be more paralyzing than it is enabling. You know, and that's why I think people end up doing these really kind of surface investigations of things. You kind of check out the Wikipedia thing, and then move on. It's very hard to have a sustained kind of comprehensive, linear, you know, inductive process in a digital environment. You know, it's much more geared toward getting your answer. It's funny, you know, Bing, the Microsoft search engine, they're trying to make their competitive advantage to Google, is that Google is supposed to be where you search, and Bing is how you make decisions.
Uh-oh.
You know, so the idea is that you've got to make a decision. You type something in, and it helps you just, bang, make that decision as if being indecisive is some, you know, intolerable state. You know, the state of not having made a choice is the state of aliveness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you know, sometimes, yeah, you make a choice. You get married or you do a thing. You sign up for something, and that choice is made, and that's fine, and that feels good. But this real obsession with closure, with just what's the answer, what's the thing, fill it out, done, next.
Well, and in fact, you know, the problem here is that because, geez, I wish I could just get, if you don't hear anything else during this show, listeners, please, things are complex. They are not simple. They are complex. Do not be fooled by simple. Everything is complex, and that's part of what makes the world beautiful, is that two different things that are completely up in opposition in terms of reality are true at the same time. And I've heard it said that the truly intelligent person can hold conflicting ideas in your head at the same time, because there's no way to escape it in the complexity of this world.
Right. I mean, that's what I love so much about the I can't ever say it right. You know, the gay, lesbian, bi, transsexual, transgender whole community. Yeah. Because, you know, what they're arguing for is, you know, let's move past this binary understanding of gender.
Right.
You know, you go on Facebook, male, female, and it's like, it's so much more complex than that. Say, I'm a guy, all right, but where are you? Where am I on the spectrum? You know, I'm not over on the Arnold side, you know, and I'm not quite over on the you know, the gay side or whatever. I'm where am I? You know, and it's like every time I've just got to make one of those decisions, I understand I'm conforming to the database, and the database needs to know one or the other. Is it this? Is it that? But it's like living on a Snap 2 grid. It's
That's
not
right.
human. It's, you know, computers live in the sort of the ticks of the clock, and human beings live in all that space between the ticks. And I feel like, you know, the more we equate life with digitality, the more we surrender to kind of the logic of the tick, and we end up leaving behind all that space, all that reality, all that nowness that that really deserves to be celebrated.
Very well said. And of course, neither of us are suggesting that people don't use technology. I mean, I'm a radio show host. I'm sitting in front of a computer right now. Although
I'm a techno
distance.
Enthusiast.
I mean, yeah, I love
I
this.
Am. I'm
I
a
love
digital
it.
Enthusiast.
No, I
I'm
love
just,
it.
I'm just telling people, let's
use it.
Really use it.
Use
stuff.
It. Don't be used by it. Right.
Right. Program
it's a
or
tool.
Be programmed. And
all right, so
look at the vast majority of people are just being programmed.
Okay, so when you say program, people's eyes glaze over. I don't like programming. I don't want to, you know.
Yeah.
So
but
how
I
do you start?
That.
All right.
When,
so, but wait.
Came
but
around, people didn't even want to read, you know.
Well, how do you start learning to program a little so that it's kind of engaging? I mean, can you give us an example of a way? I mean, you talk about kids learning how to program their own video games, their own computer games and stuff. So that's fun. You're motivated by it. How do you kind of wade in to this so that it isn't?
I mean, there's a bunch of ways. I mean, if someone's actually genuinely interested in just seeing what is programming, how does this stuff work, you know, just to understand what is code, what is the sequence of stuff, what's going on back there, you know, MIT has a kids programming language called Scratch, which you can learn online. You know, if you just go into Google and type MIT Scratch, you'll see the website, and it's a super simple, fun little language for learning how to program, you know. Or you could look at, you know, Google's going to get a lot better at this. They're, the way they're trying to compete with Apple's iPhone and all the apps there is to invite people to make their own apps and to make it really easy for people to do that. So if you go to Google and look at the app developers site, it's like, oh my gosh, you mean you can just kind of put these blocks together and sort of make something. So there's a few ways out there to just get an introduction to what this is, you know, to do programming in bigger pieces. You know, the bigger pieces you use, the easier it is to make a program. So you can make a program that just says, you know, that the end result is like print the picture, you know, and the middle thing is like, you know, throw lots of colors, you know. The first step is ask the person to, you know, to put in a word. You know, it could be, you know, something really simple, and then you see, oh, I get it. This is how all these environments really work.
Good idea. Yeah, Jeffrey is nodding his head very vigorously. I have a last question, which is kind of personal, and I, you know, I'm cool if it's too personal, but my ancestors are Jews, although I have these weird eyes that are kind of look like they're light blue, but they look like I'm a Cossack or something. It's very
well.
Odd.
Someone got
yeah,
got a
they
hold
got
of
they did. You bet they did in Eastern Europe. You betcha. That's I used to say. The way you know you're a Jew is you do a lineage and it stops around the time of the Holocaust. But,
right, mine stops with the pogroms at Kishinev.
Yeah. Well, no, that happened. Yeah. Ours too, really. But we have some people that survived that didn't make it through. Anyway, the point is that you're like me. I think you identify with the ethnicity or the cultural ethnicity, but you do refer back to the religious observance and the trappings of that. So I'm curious, just out of my own curiosity, because you're so interesting and you're so astute. What's your relationship to Judaism, the religion? I haven't been able to work this out for myself, so.
I mean, I had a better one before I wrote a book on Judaism.
Oh.
You know, I was excited by Judaism as a kind of a path towards great sort of media and cultural literacy. You know, I had an understanding of Judaism as an open source tradition. And I saw Judaism kind of hitting a dead end in my lifetime because they're trying to kind of lock down a certain understanding of this religion, partly due to the fact that they're trying to maintain a nation state and don't want critical thinking, but they're trying to get more people to just be Jews or call themselves Jews at what I think is the expense of the actual continuity of a critical tradition of people who are going to look at the world and deconstruct it and say, what are people believing today? Why are they believing that? Why is it not true? How do we move on? You know, that Judaism is not really a religion as much as the process by which people get over religion. And over time, of course, it turned into a religion itself. And I think that especially in the net age, that the real core code, if you will, of Judaism could have quite a renaissance as people have a need to understand the world from the bottom up, to get to be iconoclastic, to smash their idols, and get back to the work of Moses and his brother-in-law, which is to rewrite the commands by which human beings engineer their reality. But I wrote that book, which I saw as a very positive thing.
What's it called?
It's called Nothing Sacred.
Okay.
And institutional Judaism saw it as a gauntlet against everything that they hold sacred. So I wasn't excommunicated, but I've certainly been, you know, written enough about in institutional papers as like I'm supposedly a self-loathing anti-Semitic Jew.
Yeah.
And it's like no. I mean, maybe I loathe them, but I certainly don't loathe me.
I hear you. No, I get it. I totally get it. I just can't quite embrace the Old Testament God because he's such a mamza, which
yeah,
I think I can say on the air because it's Yiddish.
Does
he? Okay.
He does. I mean,
I'll revisit.
All right.
I'll read your book. Maybe we'll do another interview.
That'd be fun.
So this has been Your Own Health and Fitness, and we've been on the phone here with Douglas Rushkoff, R-U-S-H-K-O-F-F. His book is Program or Be Programmed, 10 Commands for a Digital Age. Boy, do I like this book. I just really want to thank you for your work and for taking the time to be on the show.
Oh, thanks so much, and thanks for what you do. I'm around anytime.
And his website will be linked on ours.
Great.
Thanks, Doug.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye. I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. There's information about Your Own Health and Fitness, our guests, our practice, a free stream of this week's show, our archive, CD copies, and there's lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out. You can also email us at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out. You can visit us on Facebook at Your Own Health and Fitness or the name of the book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health, and join us there. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.